I had to wrestle with the knowledge that we were a really good team, but had encountered one that had handled those two finals better than us. I wish we could have played the Rome final again the next day, the very next day. There was a wonderful atmosphere in Rome's Stadio Olimpico, on a beautiful night, and it was my first defeat in a European final in 5 outings. To collect a runners-up medal is a painful act when you know you could have performed much better. Bravery was a prerequisite for confronting those Barcelona sides. They were the team of their generation, just as Real Madrid were the team of theirs in the 1950s and 1960s, and AC Milan were in the early 1990s. The group of world-beaters who formed around Messi were formidable. I felt no envy towards these great sides. Regrets, yes, when we lost to them. But jealousy? No. In each of those two European Cup finals, we might have been closer to Spain's finest by playing more defensively, but by then I had reached the stage with Manchester United where it was no good us trying to win that way. I used those tactics to beat Barcelona in the 2008 semi-final, defended really deep, put myself through torture, put the fans through hell. I wanted a more positive outlook against them subsequently, and we were beaten partly because of that change in emphasis. If we had retreated to our box and kept defending tight, we might have achieved the results we craved. I'm not blaming myself. I just wish our positive approach could have produced better outcomes. Beating us in Rome accelerated Barcelona's development into the dominant team of their era. It drove them on. A single victory can have that catalytic effect. It was our second Champions League win in 4 seasons, and Pep Guardiola's team were the first Spanish side to win the league, Copa del Rey, and Champions League in the same campaign. We were the reigning European champions, but were unable to become the first in the history of the modern competition to defend that title. Yet, we shouldn't have lost that game in the Eternal City. There was a way to play against Barcelona, as we proved the year before. There is a way to stop them, even Messi. What we did 12 months previously, in the away leg, was to deploy Tevez off the front and Ronaldo at centre-forward, so we could have 2 areas of attack. We had the penetration of Ronaldo and Tevez to help us get hold of the ball. We still found it hard, of course, because Barcelona monopolised possession for such long periods, and in those circumstances, your own players tend to lose interest. They start watching the game. They are drawn into watching the ball weave its patterns. Our idea was that when we had any semblance of possession, Ronaldo would go looking for space, and Tevez would come short to get on the ball. But they were busy spectating. I made that point to them at half-time. "You're watching the game," I said. "We're not counter-attacking at all." Our method was not that of Inter Milan. They defended deep and played on the counter-attack throughout. We were in attack mode in the second half. A major inhibiting factor in Rome, I will now say, was the choice of hotel. It was a shambles. For meals, we were in a room with no light. The food was late, it was cold. I took a chef there, and they dismissed him, ignored him. On the morning of the game, 2 or 3 of our team were feeling a bit seedy, particularly Giggs. A few were feeling under the weather, and 1 or 2 played that way. The role Giggs was assigned came with a high workload that was incompatible with the slight bug in his system. It was too big a task for him to operate on top of Sergio Busquets, Barcelona's defensive midfielder, and then advance as a striker and come back in to cover again. You would never think about criticising Ryan Giggs, not in any shape or form, after what he achieved at our club. It was just a pity he was below his normal energy level that night in Rome. We started the game really well, however, with Ronaldo threatening the Barcelona defence 3 times. First from a dipping free kick, then 2 shots from distance, which heaped pressure on Victor Valdez, their goalkeeper. But 10 minutes in, we conceded a really awful goal on account of our midfield's failure to retreat in time, to stop Iniesta making a pass to Samuel Eto'o. Eto'o struck the shot, and Edwin van der Sar didn't quite deal with it as the ball slipped inside the near post. Barcelona began with Messi wide right, Eto'o through the middle, and Thierry Henry wide left. Just prior to the goal, they pushed Eto'o wider right and Messi into midfield as a deep central striker. They changed Eto'o to the right-hand side because Evra had been breaking away from Messi early on. Evra was racing forward persistently, and they changed their shape to stop him. Afterwards, Guardiola acknowledged that point. Messi had been moved to save him from having to deal with Evra. By making that alteration, Barcelona created a position for Messi he enjoys, in the centre of the park. That's where he played from then on, in that hole, which made life hard for the back four, because they were unsure whether to push in against him or stay back and play safe. After Eto's goal, and with Messi central, Barcelona had an extra man in midfield. Iniesta and Xavi just went boomf, boomf, boomf. Kept possession all night. They were superior to us at ball circulation. I won't waste time contesting that fact. Conceding the ball to Guardiola's men came at an awful price, because their numerical superiority in midfield reduced you to a spectating role again. To counteract their passing game, I sent on Tevez for Anderson at half-time and watched him miss a fine chance when he went round a defender, but decided to beat him a second time, pulling the ball back in and losing it. Barcelona's clinching goal came an hour after their first, a header, unusually by Messi, from a cross by Xavi. Later I discussed Barcelona's evolution with Louis van Gaal, their former Dutch coach. The basis of their philosophy was laid down by Johan Cruyff, a terrific coach who conceived their ideas about width and ball circulation, always with an extra man in midfield. After Bobby Robson, they went back to the Dutch way, with Van Gaal and Frank Rijkaard. What Guardiola added was a method of pressing the ball. Under Pep, they had this 3-second drill, apparently, where the defending team would be allowed no more than 3 seconds on the ball. After the win in Rome, Guardiola said, "We're fortunate to have the legacy of Johan Cruyff and Charlie Reshack. They were the fathers, and we followed them." What I could never quite understand is how their players were able to play that number of games. They fielded almost the same side every time. Success is often cyclical, with doldrums. Barcelona emerged from theirs and went in hot pursuit of Real Madrid. I don't like admitting we were beaten by a great team, because we never wanted to say those words. The biggest concession we ever wanted to make was, two great teams contested this final, but we just missed out. Our aim was to attain that level where people said we were always on a par with Europe's best. To beat Barcelona in that cycle, you needed centre-backs who could be really positive. Rio and Vidic were at an age where their preference was to defend the space. Nothing wrong with that. Quite correct. But against Barcelona, it's a limited approach. You need centre-backs who are prepared to drop right on top of Messi and not worry about what is happening behind them. Okay, he'll drift away to the side. That's fine. He's less of a threat on the side than he is through the centre. They had four world-class players. Piqué, the two centre midfield players, and Messi. Piqué was without doubt the most underrated player in their team. He's a great player. We knew that when he was a young player with us. At a European conference, Guardiola told me he was the best signing they had made. He created the tempo, the accuracy, the confidence and the penetration from that deep position. That's what we tried to nullify, by shoving our strikers on top of them and being first to the ball or forcing them to offload it. For the first 20 or 30 minutes, it worked really well. But then they score. They wriggle out. They had this wonderful talent for escapology. You put the bait in the river, and a fish goes for it. Sometimes it doesn't, though. Xavi would pass the ball to Iniesta at a pace that encouraged you to think you were going to win it. And you were not going to win it, because they were away from you. The pace of the pass, the weight of the pass, and the angle just drew you into territory you shouldn't have been in. They were brilliant at that form of deception. The Premier League desperately want a more lenient policy on work permits. There would be a danger in such a laissez-faire approach. You could flood the game with bad players, but the big clubs should be granted that freedom, because they have the ability to scout the best players. That's a bit elitist, I know, but if you want to win in Europe, one way around it is to change the work permit status in favour of the clubs. In the EU, we could take players at 16. 2 years later, our clubs converged in the final again, this time at Wembley. We had the same intention as in Rome, started well, and were then just overrun in the middle of the pitch in a 3-1 defeat. We started with Edwin van der Sar in goal, Fabio, Ferdinand, Vidic, and Evra across the back, Giggs, Park, Carrick, and Valencia in midfield, and Rooney and Hernandez up front. We didn't handle Messi. Our centre-backs weren't moving forward onto the ball. They were wanting to sit back. Yet, the preparation for that game was the best I have seen. For 10 days we practised for it in the training ground. You know the problem? Sometimes players play the occasion, not the game. Wayne Rooney, for example, was disappointing. Our tactic was for him to raid into the spaces behind the fullbacks and for Hernandez to stretch them back, which he did. But we failed to penetrate those spaces behind the fullbacks. For some reason, Antonio Valencia froze on the night. He was nervous as hell. I don't mean to be overcritical. We never really attacked the left back, who had just come back from an illness and hadn't played a lot of games. We thought that would be a big plus point for us, either him or Puyol playing there. Valencia's form leading up to the final had been excellent. He tortured Ashley Cole 2 or 3 weeks before Wembley and had twisted the blood of the fullback at Schalke. You might be better going back to your box against Barcelona, but we should have been better at pushing on top of Messi. Michael Carrick was below his best too. The first newsflash that night was that I had left Dimitar Berbatov out of the matchday squad. Instead, Michael Owen took the striker's seat on the bench. He obviously took it badly, and I felt rotten. Wembley has a coach's room, nice and private, where I explained the reasons for my decision. Dimitar had gone off the boil a bit and wasn't always the ideal substitute. I told him, if we're going for a goal in the last minute, in the penalty box, Michael Owen has been very fresh. It probably wasn't fair, but I had to take those decisions and back myself to be right. I signed Berbatov in the summer of 2008 because he had that lovely balance and composure in the attacking areas. I thought it would balance out the other players I had in the team. But by doing so, I created an impasse with Tevez, who wasn't having it. He was sub, playing, then sub again. In fairness to Tevez, he always made an impact. He would get about the game. Yet it definitely caused that blockage and gave his camp something to bargain with at other clubs. Berbatov was surprisingly lacking in self-assurance. He never had the Cantona or Andy Cole peacock quality or the confidence of Terry Sheringham. Hernandez also had high confidence. He was bright and breezy. Berbatov was not short of belief in his ability, but it was based on his way of playing. Because we functioned at a certain speed, he was not really tuned into it. He was not that type of quick reflex player. He wants the game to go slow and to work his way into the box in his own time. Or he'll do something outside the area and link the play. His assets were considerable. Although we had a few inquiries for him in the summer of 2011, I was not prepared to let him go at that stage. We had spent 30 million on him, and I was not willing to write that off just because he missed a few big games the previous season. We might as well keep him and use him. In training, he practiced getting to the ball faster. But when the play broke down, he was inclined to walk. You couldn't do that at our place. We had to regroup quickly, or we would be too open with too many players up the pitch. We needed people to react to us losing the ball, so the opposition would be under pressure quickly. But he was capable of great moments. He also had a huge appetite, of Nicky Butt proportions, head down at meal times, and sometimes with food to take home as well. Berbatov wouldn't have featured in the Wembley game, even if he had been on the bench. I had been forced to take off Fabio and send on Nani, which left me with only two options. I wanted to get Scholes on because I needed an experienced player to orchestrate our passing. So Paul came on for Carrick. We had talked about Scholes' retirement for many months, and I had tried to talk him round, to entice him with one more season. But his view was that 25 games a season were not enough. He also admitted his legs tended to be empty in the last 25 to 30 minutes. He had survived 2 knee operations and an eye problem that had kept him out for months at a time. Yet he was still playing at that high level. Phenomenal. The goal he scored at his testimonial that summer was a beauty. He gave Brad Friedel in goal no hope. It was a rocket. Eric Cantona, the visiting manager, was applauding. On TalkSport later, I heard a presenter say Paul wasn't in the top 4 of modern English players. His assertion was that Gascoigne, Lampard and Gerrard were all better players. Absolute nonsense. After our second Champions League final defeat to Barcelona, I had to ask, what is the problem here? Fact number one is that some of our players fell below the level they were capable of. A contributing factor might have been that we were accustomed to having most of the possession in games. When that advantage transferred itself to the opposition, it might have damaged our confidence and concentration. There was some credence in the theory that our players were unsettled by having to play a subservient role. Even a player such as Giggs or Ji-sung Park, who in the quarter-final against Chelsea tackled everybody and was up and down the pitch all day. We never saw him in that way against Barcelona, whose starting 11 was Valdés, Alves, Piqué, Abidal, Mascherano, Busquets, Xavi, Iniesta, Messi, Villa and Pedro. They took the lead through Pedro from one of Xavi's countless clever passes, but Rooney equalised for us after a quick exchange with Giggs. But then the Barcelona carousel really started spinning, with Messi at the controls. He and Villa scored the goals that finished us off in Van der Sar's last game for the club. I made an error at half-time. I was still focusing on winning the game and told Rooney he needed to keep running into those gaps behind the fullbacks. "We'll win the game if you keep doing that," I urged him. I forgot the big issue with playing Barcelona. So many of their games were effectively won in the first 15 minutes of the second half. I should have mentioned that to my players. I might have been better assigning Park to mark Messi for the first 15 minutes and pushing Rooney wide left. If we had employed those tactics, we might just have sneaked it. We would still have been able to counter-attack. Those changes would have left Busquets free, so maybe we would have been driven back towards our box. But we'd have posed more of a threat, with Rooney attacking from a wide left position. I had intended to replace Valencia after 10 minutes of the second half, but then Fabio was attacked by cramps again, and I was forced to rejig around his injury. My luck in finals was generally good. Favour deserted me in this one. On the balance of all those big games and the success I had enjoyed, I could hardly start pitying myself at Wembley, the scene of United's win over Benfica in 1968. We thought we might have a chance at corner kicks, but they never came our way. As our defeat was confirmed, there was no smugness about Barcelona. Not once did they flaunt their superiority. Xavi's first move, after the final whistle, was to make a move for Scholes' jersey. Footballers should have a role model. They should be saying to themselves, "He's where I want to get to." I had it with Dennis Law. Dennis was a year and a half older than me, and I looked at him and said, "That's what I want to be." In the days after that loss, I began taking a serious look at the coaching in our academy. Gary Neville, Paul Scholes and I exchanged a lot of opinions. I looked at appointing another technical coach to the academy. Our club was always capable of producing great players, and Barcelona's next wave were not better than ours. No way. Thiago was on a par with Welbeck and Cleverley, but there was no fear about the rest of theirs coming through. Looking ahead is vital. We were on to Phil Jones long before that Champions League final. I tried to buy him in 2010, but Blackburn would not sell. Ashley Young was bought to replace Giggs. The goalkeeping situation was all settled in December. Granted, David De Gea had a torrid start to his United career, but he would develop. Smalling and Evans were outstanding prospects. We had Fabio and Raphael, and Welbeck and Cleverley were coming through. Nani was 24, Rooney 25. We had a nucleus of young talent. We shed 5 that summer, because with Jones joining, it wasn't going to be easy for Wes Brown or John O'Shea to make the starting 11. They were good servants to me. The horrible part of management is telling people who have given their all for you that there is no longer a place for them in your plans. After the Premier League title parade, in the rain, we returned to the school from where we had started the procession. I spoke to Darren Gibson and asked him how he saw his future. Perhaps it wasn't the perfect place to begin that discussion, but he got the gist of what I was thinking. He was off on holiday that night, so we needed to start the conversation. Wes Brown, I struggled to reach by telephone. It was horrible to let players of that experience and loyalty to me go. I lost 5 players, aged 30 and above, and let Owen Hargreaves go. We were bringing back Welbeck, Cleverley, Mamie Diouf and Makeda from loan spells and signing three new players. The average age of the squad was reduced to around 24. With Scholes and Neville, my plan was to let them roam about the place, with the youth team, academy and reserves. Then the three of us would sit down for an assessment of how strong we were. I was going to place a big burden on them to shape the future, because they knew better than anyone what it took to be one of our players. It's something I'd wanted to do for years and years. Feed my top players into the stream. Scholes was a man of excellent opinions. His assessments were brilliant. All was in one line. There were no maybes. When we had a problem with Van Nistelrooy, Paul was instantly clear that Rood could not be allowed to cause disruption. His language was blunt. Gary asked him, "Are you sure, Scholes, eh?" Just winding him up. At that point, on the coaching side, we had Brian McClare, Mick Phelan, Paul McGuinness, Jim Ryan and Tony Whelan. They were all United players or academy graduates. I wanted to strengthen those areas. Clayton Blackmore and Quentin Fortune did a few bits on the development side. After the inquest, I told myself, when we play Barcelona next time in a Champions League final, I will have Jones and Smalling, or Smalling and Evans, right on top of Messi. I wasn't going to let him torture us again. 20. The media. The best piece of advice I ever received on the media front was from a friend called Paul Doherty, who was then at Granada TV. Great lad, Paul. He sought me out one day and said, "I've been watching your press conferences, and I'm going to point something out to you. You're giving the game away. You're showing your worries. Look in that mirror and put the Alex Ferguson face on." Appearing beleaguered is no way to handle the press. Showing your torments to them is no way to help the team or improve your chances of winning on a Saturday. Paul was right. When he gave me that advice, I was displaying the strains of the job. I couldn't allow a press conference to become a torture chamber. It was my duty to protect the dignity of the club and all that we were doing. It was important to be on the front foot and control the conversation as much as possible. Before I went through that door to face the world, I trained myself, prepared myself mentally. Experience helped. I reached the point in my Friday press conferences where I could see the line a journalist was pursuing. Sometimes they agreed a party line, telling one another, "Right, you start that, I'll go the other way." I could read them all. Experience gave me that. Plus the internal mechanism starts to work faster. I loved it when a journalist asked a big, long question because it allowed me time to prepare my answer. The hard ones were the short questions. "Why were you so bad?" That kind of pithy inquiry can cause you to elongate your response. You stretch out while you're trying to think and end up justifying your whole world to them. There's an art to not exposing the weaknesses of your team, which is always your first priority. Always. You might have a game 3 days later, and that too should be at the forefront of your thoughts when being interrogated. Winning that game is what counts, not scoring intellectual points in a news conference. The third objective is not to make a fool of yourself by answering stupidly. Those were the considerations working away in my brain as I was being grilled. The skills, that greater awareness, took years to acquire. I remember being on television as a young player and blubbing about a 6-game suspension I had received from the Scottish Football Association. I said on air, "Aye, that's the Star Chamber Justice they operate in Scotland." Right away, a letter from the SFA came flying into the club. Thinking you have a duty to be interesting, you can say something you regret. I was right that day in Scotland, but I finished up having to write a letter to explain myself. The manager asked me, "Where the hell did you get that one from? The Star Chamber Justice line?" I couldn't hide the origins of my speech. "I was reading a book and just thought it sounded good," I told him. Of course, my longest and biggest media bust-up was with the BBC, which lasted 7 years until I decided enough was enough in August 2011. There were many annoyances from my perspective, including an article in Match of the Day magazine, but the step too far was a documentary called Fergie and Son, broadcast on the 27th of May 2004 on BBC Three, which featured a horrible attack on my son Jason. They looked at the transfers of Jaap Stam to Lazio and Massimo Taibbi to Regina in relation to Jason's involvement with the elite sports agency, Before the broadcast went out, the United board cleared me, Jason and Elite of any wrongdoing in transfers, but decided that Jason could no longer act for the club on transfer dealings. The BBC would not apologise, and the allegations they made were not true. In the aftermath, Peter Salmon of the BBC came up to see me, and I told him, "You watch that programme, and tell me whether it does the BBC credit." I wanted to sue them, but my solicitor and Jason both opposed the idea. Salmon assumed his old friendship with me from Granada TV would end the standoff. "The BBC's a Manchester firm now," he said. "Great," I said, "and you need to apologise." No answer. His plan was to get me to address the Fergie and Son programme in an interview with Claire Balding. Why would I do that? But we did agree to differ in the end, and I resumed my interviews with BBC staff. By then, I had made my point. More generally, Sky Television changed the whole media climate by making it more competitive and adding to the hype. Take the coverage of the Suarez biting incident in the spring of 2013. I was asked about it in a press conference. The headline on my answer was, "Ferguson feels sympathy for Liverpool." They asked me a question about Suarez, and I said, "I know how they feel because Cantona received a 9-month ban for kung fu kicking a fan." My point was, never mind 10 games, try 9 months. Yet they ran a headline suggesting I felt sorry for Suarez. Another headline was, "Ferguson says Jose Mourinho is going to Chelsea." The question they'd asked me was, "Who will be your main challenger next year?" I replied that Chelsea would be there next season and added that if the papers were right and Mourinho was going back, it would give them a boost. The headline became, "Ferguson says Mourinho is going back to Chelsea." I had to text Mourinho to explain. He texted back and said, "It's okay. I know. I saw it." That headline ran every 10 minutes. Mourinho did end up back at Chelsea. But that's not the point. So there was an intensity and volatility about the modern media I found difficult. I felt that by the end it was hard to have relationships with the press. They were under so much pressure it was not easy to confide in them. When I first came to Manchester, I was wary of some but wasn't guarded in the way I was in my final years. Characters like John Bean and Peter Fitton were decent lads. Bill Thornton, David Walker, Steve Miller, decent guys. And I had my old friends from Scotland. On tours, we used to have a night out with the press lads. One evening, we ended up back in my room and Beano was in striking form, tap dancing on my table. Another night, I was in bed at about 11 o'clock when the phone rang and a voice said,
"Alex, can you confirm or deny that you were seen in a taxi with Mark Hughes tonight?"
It was John Bean. I told him, "It would be very difficult, John, because he was playing for Bayern Munich tonight in a European tie." John said,
"Oh, yes. Oh, what's that game?"
I banged down the phone. John then turns up on the Friday. "Oh, a million apologies, Alex. I know you'll accept my apology." And sat down. Latterly, we had a lot of young reporters who dressed more casually than the men I had known in my early years. Maybe it was a generational thing, but it just didn't sit well with me. It's a difficult job for those young reporters because they are all under so much pressure from their editors. Forget Off the Record. It doesn't exist anymore. I banned a couple of reporters in 2012, 2013 for using Off the Record remarks. I banned another for saying Rooney and I never spoke in training sessions and that everyone at the club could see it. Not true. I didn't read all the papers, but from time to time our media staff would point things out that were inaccurate. The process can drain you. Years ago, I used to take action, but it ends up costing you money. As for an apology, 40 words tucked away on page 11 was a long way from a story with banner headlines on the back page. So what was the point? In banning reporters, I would be saying, "I'm not accepting your version of events." Again, I was in a strong position because I had been at Man United a long time and had been successful. If I'd been some poor guy struggling in a bad run of results, the scenario would have been different. In most cases, I felt an underlying sympathy because I knew that extrapolation or exaggeration was a product of the competitive nature of the business. Newspapers are up against Sky Television, websites and other social media channels. Any Premier League manager should have an experienced press officer. Someone who knows the media and can act quickly on stories. You can't stop them all, but you can warn the author when the facts are wrong and seek corrections. As a backup, a good press officer can extricate you from trouble. Every day, for 24 hours, Sky News is rolling. A story will be repeated over and over again. Dealing with the press is becoming more and more problematic for managers. Say Paul Lambert is having a bad time at Aston Villa. The press conference is bound to be dominated by negativity. Only someone who knows the press can train a manager for that. When I had my bad spell at United, Paul Doherty told me, "You're tense. You're bait for them. Before you get in that press conference, look in the mirror. Rub your face. Get your smile on. Get your act together. Be sure they can't eat you up." That was marvellous advice. And that's what you have to do. Most times, you have to go with the flow and make the best of it. A standard question is, do you feel pressure? Well, of course you do. But don't give them a headline. I held my press conferences before training. A lot of managers hold theirs afterwards. In that scenario, you're concentrating on your training session and not thinking about the press. For a 9 a.m. press conference, I would have been briefed by Phil Townsend, our Director of Communications, on what might come up. He would tell me, for example, that I might be asked about the Luis Suarez biting incident, say, or the Godolphin doping scandal in racing, or a possible move for a player such as Lewandowski. I always started by talking about players who would be available for that particular game. Then the emphasis would usually switch to issues around the game, personalities. The Sundays would often look to build a piece around one subject. Michael Carrick's good form, for instance. I was generally fine in press conferences. The most difficult challenge was how to address the problem of bad refereeing. I was penalised for making remarks about referees because my reference point was the standards I set for football, not match officials. I wasn't interested in the standard referees set themselves. As a manager, I felt entitled to expect refereeing levels to match those of the game they were controlling. And as a group, referees aren't doing their job as well as they should be. They talk of refereeing now as a full-time job, but that's codswallop. Most start at 16 or so, when they're kids. I admire the impulse to want to referee. The game needs that. I wanted to see men such as the Italian Roberto Rossetti referee here. He's 6 feet 2 inches tall, a commanding figure, built like a boxer, and he flies over the pitch, calms players down. He's in control. I like to see the top referees in action. I enjoyed observing proper authority, properly applied. It would have been hard to get rid of a Premier League referee on grounds of incompetence or weight. They all have lawyers. The union is very strong. Plus, young referees are not coming through, so they cling to the ones they have. Refereeing was the one area of the game where maybe I should have walked away from interviews without expressing my opinions. The following week, I might be the beneficiary of a decision in our favour. So to go overboard after one bad decision could be interpreted as selective outrage. I support the Referees Association. At Aberdeen, I would bring them into training to help them get fit. I like standards. I like to see a fit referee, and I don't think that levels of fitness are high enough currently in the English game. How far they run is not the correct standard of measurement. It's how quickly they cover the ground. If there's a counter-attack on, can they reach the right end of the pitch in time? In fairness, if you look at our 2009 Champions League semi-final against Arsenal, when Rossetti was the referee, he was still 20 yards behind the player when we put the ball in the net. It took us 9 seconds to score. So you're asking the referee to run 100 yards in 9 seconds. Only Usain Bolt could manage that. As a rule, I felt that the Football Association tend to go after the high-profile targets because they know it will bring favourable publicity. If you look at the Wayne Rooney incident against West Ham, when he swore into the camera, we felt they pressurised the referee, and Rooney ended up with a 3-match suspension. The justification was that it's not nice for children to see a player swear into a TV camera. I can see that. But how often have you seen players swear over the years? It was never really possible to work out who was running English football's governing body. You would get Exeter schools having a say. Greg Dyke, the new chairman, has to reduce the numbers involved in decision-making. A committee of 100 people can't produce sensible management. These committees are set up to honour people's contribution to the game, rather than make the organisation run smoothly. It's an institutional problem. Reformers go in there 6 feet 2 inches tall and come out 5 feet 4 inches. Our behaviour in big games was generally excellent. One newspaper cited the case of the referee, Andy D'Urso, being harassed by Roy Keane and Jaap Stam, which we stamped on. Me saying it's none of their business evidently irked the FA. I also pointed out that this was the League Cup, not the FA Cup. I was never much impressed with the work of the FA's compliance unit. When I criticised Alan Wiley for his physique in the autumn of 2009, I was making a wider point about the fitness of referees. In my opinion, Alan Wiley was overweight when I made that point after a 2-2 draw with Sunderland at Old Trafford. The comment that landed me in hot water was, "The pace of the game demanded a referee who was fit. He was not fit. You see referees abroad who are as fit as butchers' dogs. He was taking 30 seconds to book a player. He was needing a rest. It was ridiculous." Later, I apologised for any personal embarrassment caused to Alan Wiley and said my intention had been to highlight a serious and important issue in the game. But 16 days after the Sunderland game, I was charged by the FA with improper conduct. I had twice been banned from the touchline, in 2003 and again in 2007, for having my say about referee Mark Clattenburg. Later, I was fined £30,000 and banned from the touchline for 5 matches for my comments about referee Martin Atkinson in the wake of our 2-1 defeat at Chelsea. After my comments about Alan Wiley, former referee Jeff Winter suggested a FIFA-style stadium ban might be appropriate. By the end, I felt we hadn't had a really top Premier League referee for a long time. I know Graeme Paul had that arrogant streak, but he was the best decision-maker. He had such an ego that it detracted from his performances, and when he entered one of his stroppy moods, it could be difficult for you. He was the best judge of an incident over my time at Manchester United. When a referee is working in front of 44,000 at Anfield or 76,000 at Old Trafford and he gives a goal that goes against the home team and the crowd scream, it does affect a lot of them. That's another distinction, the ability to make decisions against the tide, against the roar of the crowd. The old saying that a referee was a homer does apply. It's not to say a ref is cheating, more that they are influenced by the force of emotion in the crowd. Anfield was probably the hardest place for a match official to be objective, because it was such a closed-in, volatile environment. There is an intimidation factor from fans to referees, not just at Liverpool, but across the game. 40 years ago, crowds were not frenzied the way they are today. So perhaps it would serve a higher purpose for the referee to attend a press conference with his supervisor alongside him and explain how he saw it. For instance, I would have found it interesting to hear from the Turkish referee who handled our Champions League tie against Real Madrid at Old Trafford in March 2013 and listen to what he had to say about Nani's sending off, which was appalling. A brief referee's press conference might have been a step forward. You can't stop progress. Take football boots. I was totally against the modern boot, yet manufacturers were pouring money into football and therefore could not be challenged. The level of gimmickry is now very high. To get young kids to buy pink boots, orange boots. A lot of clubs use the kit manufacturers as part of the deal to sign a player. We can get you a deal with Nike or Adidas and so on. They have to get their money back, and it's through boots. As an audience, we are never going to be satisfied with the referees, because we are all biased towards our own teams. But full-time referees have not been successful, except in terms of man management. It's impossible for a person to do his normal job and still follow the kind of training programme referees are assigned. So the system is flawed. There should be full-time referees who report to St George's Park every day. You may say, how are they going to travel from Newcastle to Burton-upon-Trent every day? Well, if we signed a player from London, we found him a house in Manchester. Robin van Persie, for example. If they want the best refereeing system, they should be as professional as the Premier League clubs with the money the game now has. Mike Riley, the head of the Professional Game Match Officials Board, once claimed they lacked the finance to take such steps. If he is right, It is incredible that football lacks the resources for proper professional refereeing, with $5 billion in revenues from television. That is ridiculous. Think of the sums available in parachute payments to clubs relegated to the Championship. If referees are going to be full-time, the system should reflect that. It should be done properly. In Europe, Champions League referees have an arrogance about them because they know they won't see you again the following weekend. I was in four finals, and there was only one where the referee could be recognised as a top official. Pierluigi Collina in the Barcelona final of 1999. I've lost two important European ties to Jose Mourinho, not because of the performance of the players, but because of the referee. The Porto game in 2004 was unbelievable. The worst decision he made that night was not the disallowed Scholes goal that would have put us 2-0 in front. When Ronaldo broke away with a few minutes to go, he was brought down by the left back. The linesman flagged for a free kick, but the referee chose to play on. Porto went up the park, got a free kick. Tim Howard parried it out, and they scored in injury time. So we had plenty of experience of bad decisions against us in Europe. I was at an AC Milan Inter game, and a senior Inter official said to me, "Do you know the difference between the English and the Italians? In England, they don't think a game can ever be corrupt. In Italy, they don't think a game cannot be corrupt." In England, on the plus side, there was an improvement in man management. That was good. The communication between match officials and players was much more constructive. People in authority have to be able to make decisions, and a lot of them lack the ability to reach them quickly. The human element tells you a referee can be wrong, but the good ones will make the correct decisions more often than not. The ones who make the wrong ones are not necessarily bad referees. They just lack that talent for making the right calls in a tight time frame. It was the same with players. What makes a difference in the last third? It's your decision making. We were on to players about it all the time. If I were starting again, I would force every player to learn chess, to give them the ability to concentrate. When you first learn chess, you can be 3 or 4 hours finishing a game. But when you've mastered it and start playing 30-second chess, that's the ultimate. Quick decisions under pressure. What football is all about. 21. United's 19th title. In the build-up to us winning our 19th English League title, there was this constant question about us beating Liverpool's record. My view was that we would pass their haul of 18 championships at some point anyway, so there was no need to make a fuss about it in that particular season. I wanted our attention focused on the campaign itself, but it was something I always felt we needed to achieve. The soonest Dalgleish Liverpool teams were the benchmark for English football in the 1980s, when I made my first foray into management south of the border. Those Liverpool sides were formidable. I had suffered against them with Aberdeen and brought those memories with me to Manchester. In one European tie, we had lost 1-0 at Pittodrie, played really well for the first 20 minutes at Anfield, but still ended up 2-0 down at half-time. I did my usual thing in the dressing room, and, as the players were leaving, one, Drew Jarvie, said, "Come on, lads! 2 quick goals and we're back in it." We were 3-0 down in aggregate at Anfield, and he was talking about 2 quick goals as if they were ours to take. I looked at Drew and said, "God bless you, son." Later, the players would hammer Drew with a quote. They would say, "We weren't playing forfer, you know." When that great Liverpool side were 1-0 up against you, it was impossible to get the ball off them. It would be boomp, boomp around the park. Souness would spread the play. Hansen, Lawrenson, Thompson. Whatever the combination at the back, they were comfortable in the ball. When I moved to United, they still had Ian Rush, John Aldridge, that calibre of player. Buying John Barnes and Peter Beardsley just elevated them again. I said at the time, "I want to knock them off their perch." I can't actually remember saying that, but the line is attributed to me. Anyway, it was a representation of how I felt. So, I have no objection to it being in the newspaper cuttings. Manchester United's greatest rival, though it changed towards the end, was Liverpool. Historically, industrially, and football-wise. The games were always emotionally intense events. Our league success in 1993 opened the door, and by the turn of the century, we had added a further 5 championships. In 2000, I looked at Liverpool and knew there was no easy way back for them. They were in for a long haul. Youth development was spasmodic. You had no feeling that Liverpool were a threat again. The impetus was all with us. On the day we reached 18 titles to match their record, I knew fine well we were going to pass them, the way our club was operating. The weekend of our 19th coronation was an extraordinary one for the city of Manchester. City won their first trophy since the 1976 League Cup, with a 1-0 win over Stoke in the FA Cup final. And we drew 1-1 at Blackburn with a 73rd-minute penalty by Rooney. In 1986, when I arrived, Liverpool led United 16-7 in league titles won. This was the season in which Chelsea had spent £50 million on Fernando Torres, and City had invested £27 million in Edin Dzeko, while Javier Hernandez turned out to be a bargain for us at £6 million. We went 24 games unbeaten before losing at Wolves on the 5th of February 2011, and finished with only 4 defeats. A turning point in the race was the 4-2 win at West Ham in early April, after we'd been 2-0 down at the interval. I made the point that several of our players had sampled success for the first time and would want more. Valencia, Smalling and Hernandez among them. Winning the title was the most important aim that season, with the 19 as a bonus. By the time I finished, we had moved on to 20, which was a number that the fans chanted with great relish. There was no evidence in my final season that Liverpool, despite some excellent performances, possessed a team who might win the league. I was coming out of the Grand National meeting with Cathy in April 2013, and two Liverpool fans came up alongside to say, "Hey Fergie, well I'm with you next season." They were good lads. "Well, you need to buy 9 players," I said. They looked crestfallen. "9? One said, "Wait till I tell the boys in the pub that." I think he must have been an Everton fan. "I don't think we need 9, said the other, as he traipsed away. I nearly shouted, "Well, 7 then." Everyone was laughing. That summer, we knew Manchester City were emerging as the team we would have to beat. The danger no longer emanated from London or Merseyside. It was so close, you could smell it. An owner with the means to make this a serious municipal contest stood between us and control of the city. We continued down our path of building up strength for the future and hoped it would see us through. The big player we needed to replace was Edwin van der Sar. Although most people assumed Manuel Neuer was going to be our target, he was on our agenda. We had scouted David De Gea for a long time, right through from when he was a boy. We always thought he was going to be a top goalkeeper. In the summer of 2011, also, Ashley Young had a year to run in his contract at Aston Villa. He was a solid buy, English, versatile, could work either side of the pitch, could play off the front, and had a decent goal-scoring record. Given that Ji-Sung Park was coming up to 31, and with Ryan Giggs's advancing age, I thought it was a good time to move for Young. Giggs was never going to be a thrusting outside left anymore, in the way he had been in the past. We picked up Young for £16 million, which was a reasonable fee. Maybe a pound or two more than we expected to pay, with him in the final year of his contract, but we concluded the deal quickly. Ashley ran into trouble against QPR in the 2011-2012 season, when Sean Derry was sent off and our player was accused of diving. I left him out for the next game, and told him that the last thing he needed as a Manchester United player was a reputation for going down easily. It wasn't a penalty kick against QPR, and Sean Derry's sending off was not rescinded. Ashley did it 2 weeks in a row, but we stopped it. Going to ground too willingly was not something I tolerated. Ronaldo had issues with the same tendency early in his career, but the other players would give him stick for it on the training ground. The speed he was travelling at, you had only to nudge Cristiano to knock him over. We spoke to him many times about it. "You fouled me," he would say. "Yes, but you're overdoing it. You're exaggerating it," we would tell him. He eradicated it from his game and became a really mature player. Luka Modric was an example of a player in the modern game who would never dive. Stays on his feet. Giggs and Scholes would never dive. Drogba was a prominent offender. A Barcelona game at Stamford Bridge in 2012 was the worst example. The press were never hard on him, except in that Champions League fixture. If the media had been tougher on him 5 years earlier, it would have been better for the game. The purchase of Phil Jones was a long-term plan from when Sam Allardyce was Blackburn manager. When Rovers beat us in the FA Youth Cup, I called Sam the next day and said, "What about the boy Jones?" Sam laughed and said,
"No, he'll be in the first team on Saturday."
Which he was, and he stayed there. Sam was a big fan of Jones. Blackburn wouldn't sell him in the 2011 January transfer window because they were in a relegation battle. By the end of the season, every club was on his tail. Liverpool, Arsenal, Chelsea. He spoke to all four clubs, but we managed to coax him to United at 19 years of age. At the point we signed Phil, I was unsure what his best position would be. Later, I came to feel it would be at centre-back. He gave us versatility. He could play almost anywhere. In the 2011 Community Shield, I took Ferdinand and Vidic off at half-time and assigned Jones and Evans to push right on top of the opposition. Evans is good at that too, breaking into the middle of the pitch. Vidic and Ferdinand were more old-school. They have got good heads, understand the game well, don't get caught out. They were a great partnership. Increasingly though, I could apply variations at centre-back and Jones was a major part of my thinking. Evans, I think, needed a shake. He didn't appreciate me signing Jones and Smalling. It caused him to question my opinion of him. But he proved himself in his own right and did increasingly well for us. It's always gratifying when a player responds to new arrivals by redoubling his own efforts. Tom Cleverley, another young hopeful, was the victim of a shocking tackle against Bolton early in that season, which killed his year in many ways. He came back after about a month and we played him right away against Everton. A recurrence of the injury then kept him out for about 3 months. The plan was to send him off for an operation, which he didn't want. It would have kept him out for 9 months. He wanted to carry on, and it worked. But, by that time, I had Scholes and Carrick back. I was never able to place Tom in the side regularly. He's a very clever player, the boy. Very intelligent. He's mobile and a good finisher. He was in the London Olympic squad, which pleased me because he needed a challenge to lift his self-belief right up. Darren Fletcher, meanwhile, was battling a colonic illness. In the summer of 2012, it was possible he might have an operation, but he needed to be well to go under the knife. With the setback he had, he was going to be out until December. The previous season, I had him with the reserves to do some coaching. He enjoyed that. Scholesy had gone back to the first team. Darren delivered a couple of half-time talks in reserves games and was impressive. De Gea, who was 20 when we signed him for €24 million from Atletico Madrid, had a torrid time to begin with. It was obvious he lacked the physique of Van der Sar or Schmeichel. That part of his body needed to be developed, and we devised a programme to help him add muscle mass. A complication for him was that we lost Ferdinand and Vidic in our first game of the 2011-2012 league campaign, a 2-1 win at West Bromwich Albion, in which he allowed a weak shot from Shane Long to slip through. I described the battering he received in our penalty box at West Brom as his welcome to England. Vidic was out for 6 weeks and Rio for 3. De Gea then had Smalling and Jones playing in front of him, young players. He did all right, but was a few degrees short of infallible. There were issues with his handling of the players in front of him. When we played Liverpool in the FA Cup in January, he conceded the first goal from a corner kick. He should have dealt with that better. Not just him, but Evans and Smalling, the centre-backs on that occasion. Their positioning was bad, which locked De Gea into his 6-yard area. But it's the goalkeeper who takes the blame for those rocky moments. In the decisive Premier League game against City at the Etihad Stadium the following April, Jones blocked him in and stopped him getting out to deal with a corner kick that led to Kompany's goal. There was progress to be made on that front. As the season wore on, though, he was more and more effective and self-assured. Some of his saves were miraculous. Our instincts were correct all along. He was one of the world's best young keepers, and we were proud to have him with us, where he could develop as so many others had before. At Real Madrid, in the first leg of our Champions League round of 16 tie in February 2013, he saved brilliantly from Ronaldo, Fabio Contrao and Sami Khedira. David couldn't speak the language and he had to learn to drive, another illustration of how young he was. It could never be easy for a goalkeeper coming to England from continental Europe at 20 years of age. If you recall the big goalkeeping moves of the last two decades or so, Buffon was outstanding from the moment he arrived at Juventus as a teenager. But very few who have made a move on the scale of De Gea, going to United, have clicked straight away. We always look to invest in the future, though. He will be one of the very best, and I was delighted when he was named in the PFA Team of the Year in my last season. Jones was unfortunate in that 2011-2012 season in sustaining a succession of niggling injuries. Young could look back on an encouraging season in which he had scored 8 goals. For a winger, that's not bad. He can draw on a good understanding of the game and a high stamina level. With an extra half yard of pace, his arsenal would have been complete. But his speed was hardly deficient, and he developed a knack of slipping inside onto his right foot, his strongest foot, and delivering from there. He was excellent through the middle as well, but we were blessed with many options in that area of the field. I was very pleased with Ashley, though. He was a quiet boy and a good trainer. The three of them, Jones, Young and De Gea, were good sorts. Briefly, the idea was mooted of an England comeback for Paul Scholes, but it was never a serious possibility. Paul would tire at the end of games in his later years because he was not born with the genes of Ryan Giggs, and he had little interest in playing international football again. Scholes, he still offered us a tempo and a platform for our game when he returned in January 2012. There was nobody better in the rhythm section of our team. In fairness, the FA came to accept Paul's aversion to being recalled. Fabio Capello's assistant approached him before the 2010 World Cup, but there was no approach ahead of Euro 2012 in Poland and Ukraine. Michael Carrick was another interesting case study. No England manager appeared to regard him as a starting midfield player. Michael grew up sitting on the England bench, and he had no desire to spend all summer in that observer's role at Euro 2012. As it turned out, he took the opportunity to clear out his Achilles. Michael's handicap was, I feel, that he lacked the bravado of Frank Lampard and Steven Gerrard. Lampard, for me, was a marvellous servant for Chelsea. But I didn't think of him as an elite international footballer. And I am one of the few who felt Gerrard was not a top, top player. When Scholes and Keane were in our team, Gerrard seldom had a kick against us. With England, Michael Carrick suffered in the shadow of those two big personalities. Playing Lampard and Gerrard was a nightmare for England managers, because they were incompatible in a 4-4-2 formation. The team functioned better with Hargreaves in central midfield in 2006. By the by, in the World Cup quarter-final against Portugal in 2006, which England lost, I told Steve McLaren that he and Eriksen should have had the players celebrating and buoyant after getting to penalties with 10 men, following Rooney's dismissal. A sense of achievement against the odds should have taken hold among Eriksen's penalty takers. Little things like that count. It would have lifted England's players. I had some strange dealings on the England front. After Capello resigned, the FA wrote to me to ask me not to talk about the England manager's job. At the time, everybody was touting Harry Redknapp as the probable successor, and all I did was endorse the popular view that Harry would be ideally suited to the role. I don't know why they jumped on me that way. Clearly they had it in mind that Harry was not going to be the next England manager, even though everyone assumed he would. I was offered the England job on 2 occasions. Adam Crozier, chief executive of the FA from 2000 to 2002, came to see me before Eriksen was appointed in 2001. The first time was before that, when Martin Edwards was chairman, around the time Kevin Keegan took the reins in 1999. There was no way I could contemplate taking the England job. Can you imagine me doing that? A Scotsman? I always joked that I would take the position and relegate them, make them the 150th rated country in the world, with Scotland 149. The England job requires a particular talent, and that skill is the ability to handle the press. Steve McLaren made the mistake of trying to be pally with one or two. If you cut 90% out, the others are after your body. If one person gives you favourable coverage, the others will hound you. No, it wasn't a bed of nails I was ever tempted to lie on.
22. Man City. Champions. Back in the sanctuary of our home, Cathy said, "That was the worst day of my life."